293 in relation to the farmland regulations. Are you of the view that you need to do a section 293 in relation to the stock exclusion regulations or not?
I have made some changes already, or recommended some changes, proposed some changes, to align with the stock exclusion regulations as much as I think I'm able to. I think to properly align them, you'd have to go to a 293, I think. They're so different, the stock exclusion regulations, whereas PC1 is about authorising farming, as I think. Stock exclusion regulations are about individual activities with particular types of animals and things, and it's very hard to see those two things and line them up in an easy way. So I think to do more than what I've suggested already would need something, I think it goes beyond the appeal of the scope of the regulations.
So if you just made no changes and people had to comply with the regulations and PC1,
yes,
there'd be no need for a process, but by aligning them in PC1, you've got to go through 293.
Beyond what I've already suggested. So we've taken out, that was winter grazing stuff. Stock exclusion regulations. There may be a better way of writing Schedule C so that it aligns better with those. I don't believe that stock exclusion regulations are sufficiently protective of water bodies to give effect to 235 mana. So it depends what changes you're suggesting.
I'm not suggesting any changes because what I'm understanding is you're not making it any less restrictive or more restrictive in making the changes. So it's largely the same as what the notified version, the decisions version of PC1 is, or have you made some changes that would need to, that are more restrictive than the regulations?
We have made changes. The changes themselves that we've made are probably no more restrictive than the decision version.
Mm.
Yeah.
So why would you need a section 293 process?
Oh, for the stock exclusion, not for that. I don't think you would need it. Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to get.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, sir.
So you're not looking for a section 293?
Not process. For the stock exclusion.
Okay.
Sorry. I'll...
No, that's okay. I may not have put it very clearly.
No, I was probably recovering from last time.
I'd just like to go back to the issue raised by Mr. Pinnell about double certification.
Yes.
Because there are various situations. Presumably where PC1 does not require a farm plan for a farm of over 20 acres, not 20 hectares, you would accept a single certification for the farm plan regulations and PC1 regulations? Or requirements, right?
So you're talking about under Rule 3.3, the mill activity rule for...
Yes.
Yes. Yes, there's no additional role for the Regional Council in terms of that committed activity rule, so it's just a technical certification that the farm meets the standards.
Yeah.
Yep.
So no double duplication possible here?
No.
Okay. Now, where a consent's required,
yes.
The consent officer would have to satisfy themselves that the planning provisions have been properly addressed, the effects are okay, those kind of things.
Yes.
What we're talking about, isn't it?
Yes.
And could that be done partly in the farm environment, the farm environment plan in terms of effects or not?
I think the farm environment plan is, the certifier needs to certify that it meets the standards.
Yes.
Beyond that, I don't think it's doing an effects assessment, if you like.
Okay. Mm. Right, so there is a definite need, or there could be a definite need for a consent officer to say, well, I'm not happy that the effects are properly addressed, so you need to...
I think that's right.
...have conditions.
So, yes.
So that's the way in which the double certification issue would be addressed.
Yes, you could say that.
Okay, thank you. Where I glance it on, I might be able to see what question you have. terms of an issue that was raised this morning in terms of some of the permitted activity rules, particularly for, say, for dry stock, could go up to the limit in the rule. Where is that provision that you can't exceed what you had at the date of notification or whatever? Can you just point me to the provision in the rule which says that?
That's not a provision in the rule. The rule just has thresholds which apply at the time, at any time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But you said that there are clear provisions that people can't sort of go up. They can't sort of become more intense, discharge more than what they were doing at the start date for the plan. Is that correct? What I'm concerned about is, again, another point raised in evidence is that there seems to be the inconsistency that everyone else is required to stay the same or go down, but in that particular case, the submitter or the expert made the point that it could go up for dry stock farming.
In terms of increasing intensity?
Yes.
Yes.
And discharging more contaminants, basically.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, that comes through because the rules have a maximum stocking rate, winter stocking rate. So some farms, the concern is that some farms will increase their stocking rate up to that maximum.
Yes, yes, that's the issue.
And while I recognise that that's a possibility, there's certain words in PC1 to try and avoid that. And there's a number of places where there's clear direction, for example, for a general improvement farming to reduce contaminants. For permitted activity farms, the main restriction here is in Schedule D1, Part D, Number 2A. So for permitted activity farms, need to demonstrate. Yeah, sorry, that's the Schedule D1 Part D, which is the standards, and then 2A.
So which clause again?
2A. So one there's a lot of cross outs, and then halfway through there's demonstrated each 5-yearly review. And then for permitted farms, I would expect the same kind of idea written into the conditions of consent, that there's demonstration. It doesn't specifically say that for permitted activity farms in Schedule D2. I would expect, given the policy directions, that there will be the same restriction to increasing contaminant discharges.
Okay, thank you. Now, have you given any thought to staging of mitigation measures, because you've got the fencing of the streams, you've got the fencing of the wetlands, you've got the fencing of lakes. There are a lot of ideas there, and there could be some very substantial costs.
Yes.
Have you given any thought to the concept of the best bang for your buck sort of thing? In terms
only in really general sense. And so, there was the original things in PC1 around priority contaminants and starting to deal with those first on the farm, which might allow some staging. Doesn't say so, but it feels to me that there is an ability under Schedule C, the SOC exclusion, that you might not be able to fence everything that needs to be fenced right now, but you might be able to propose other mitigations through stock management in the interim for the next 2 or 3 years or whatever it might be. So I think you can stage mitigations in terms of stock exclusion through those regulations. The idea that was floated sometime last week, where perhaps there should be a 10 degree number and then somewhere down the track a 15 degree number in terms of where fencing is required. I haven't thought about those kind of provisions, but there's certainly room for thought there.
And so you wouldn't have an objection in principle to that kind of concept being incorporated?
No, not at all.
because that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, well, that's where I was going.
Yeah. In terms of the 50 square metre area for wetlands,
yes.
Where does that figure come from? I've seen it in the hearing's decision.
Yes.
And I think it simply says we've decided that it'll be 50 square metres.
That's right.
Any guidance on?
So the notified version of PC1 didn't have an area limit, so it was stop exclusion from all wetlands.
Oh,
and
okay.
And so the panel said in their decision report, paragraph 1683, and it's the only part I've seen that talks about it. However, it says, however, there's no full section 32 cost benefit evaluation on fencing and excluding from wetlands. The panel was reluctant to impose a blanket rule for all wetlands to be protected, irrespective of size. The panel has therefore recommended, in addition to the other controls, that stock exclusion applies. Does not apply to wetlands less than 50 square metres. Now, that's the only reference I've seen to 50 square metres. So I guess they were, again, looking for something that was, some kind of cut-off to make things reasonable, and that was where it shows. I don't know if they heard evidence on whether that was the right number or not. I haven't seen anything. And as I say, I wasn't at a lot of the hearings. So
okay.
It's possible somebody has suggested reasons for that, but I haven't seen them.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. One of the things that's been an issue on other cases I've been involved in is the time required for certain activities to be, or mitigation measures to be put in place.
Yes.
And I've seen various time frames of 2 years and various things like that.
Yes.
But in some cases it could quite easily be 10 years after there's big dollar numbers involved.
Yes.
How do you see, or possibly even longer, how do you see that being addressed in a consistent way?
Yes, so it depends on what we're talking about in terms of how I see it. So stock exclusion, I've sort of said that there may be some interim mitigations that you can do before you fence, so that's one issue. The other place where this comes up is in Schedule D1, again, and it's the provisions or the standards around infrastructure, races, laneways, bridges, other infrastructure.
Yes.
So that's Schedule D1, Part D, number 6. And in that case, for example, particularly 6B, where it says existing races, laneways, culverts, crossings, bridges, which were established before the chapter becomes operative, shall be relocated, redesigned, or managed. And those three words were put in there through the my rebuttal evidence, I think it was, to meet the standard in 6A, so it's referring back to 6A. The standard in 6A is about mostly about runoff being directed away from permanent or intermittent water bodies.
Yes.
So the requirement is to relocate, redesign, or manage those infrastructure so that runoff is directed away from water bodies. It's a 3-year allowance to do that. I'm assuming that mostly to direct water away from those pieces of infrastructure, it's drainage works, my assumption, based on the people I've talked to. So, it may be that there's some major shifts needed, but because of the language of relocated, designed, or managed, it doesn't seem unreasonable to at least manage the issue within 3 years. But it's arguable, of course, and there may be cases where you can't.
Yeah, that's where I'm coming from, really, because if you had requirements to do fencing within 2 years, this within 3 years,
yeah.
Something,
yeah.
And you could find that you get some pretty big numbers that are not achievable.
Yes, exactly.
If that happens, what's the fallback position? You have to go for a different type of consent, is that right?
I think that's right. Mostly it means for the fencing, you can have a so it's rule 3144, so it's controlled activity for farming, and it allows, I'm trying to find a tailored solution for stock exclusion, so that allows you to do something different, but you're still having a tailored solution to that. If you can't do that, then you'd flick into the discretionary rule, I guess.
Mm.
In t- turn to the standards in Schedule D1, which are permit activity standards, if you really can't meet them, then yes, you'll need to go to the next level, which is a control
rule. Okay, yeah. Look, I understand exactly why those provisions are there, but I'm looking at the practicality of situations where they're not achievable, but it would mean you've got to go to a controlled activity.
Yeah.
Okay.
In most cases, we've tried to do the standards so that they're not unreasonable standards to meet. Not to say that all of them can be met all the time, so there could still be an issue, yes. We've tried to set it up so that those standards are relatively achievable.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. Okay. Now, the issue of review clauses was raised this morning, and that's something that interests me.
Yes.
Do you see any need to include a specific requirement to undertake reviews at any particular stage before in relation to the 2024 plan change, for example?
Yes.
Presumably, rules would be have to take legal effect immediately relating to water. Would that be correct?
I assume so.
Yeah. So, do you see any need for reviews of any consents granted before that, or this is me coming from a non-planning background?
Yeah. I mean, the main problem I have again is that there's got to be good, clear reason for the review. So you've got to know that whatever's happening in this subcatchment, if you're going to do that subcatchment level,
yes,
you need to know that whatever the farming is going on there, that it's having this kind of impact on the water bodies, and therefore those consents need to be reviewed. Now, I mean, you could do that. I'm just not sure that reviewing is the best thing. I'd personally rather wait 10 years, get a good record of information, both in terms of water quality and what people are doing on their land, and then deal with it then. That's my preference. It's not to say there isn't a role for review clauses, which is why it's allowed for there.
I've never seen
reviews used really successfully, but I'm limited knowledge in that situation.
That's why I raise it, because a number of people say, well, councils never do a review. And so I just want to understand that issue, but I think you've explained it very well.
Thank you.
Are there any provisions that will assist the council to understand the extent to which permitted activities are being undertaken in accordance with the standards? When you've got 2,500 of these things out there, or whatever the number is,
yes,
it's putting a lot of faith in everything going as it should do.
Yes.
And then wait for 10 years and find there was a problem.
Yes.
Have you given any thought to that as an issue?
Been sort of thinking about the information, so the information to be provided in the farm environment plans. So in Rule 3.11.4.3, for example, number 6, condition 6, where the farm environment plan needs to demonstrate evidence to demonstrate the risk for dairy farming, the risk scorecard value for dry stock farming, the winter stocking rate and cattle winter stocking rate, and for arable farming, the annual tons and types of fertilizer used. It's not clear, but I think it would be useful to have sort of updated information on those kind of statistics so that you can kind of see if there is intensification occurring. We haven't specifically said that has to happen annually. It's been a debate with some of the parties, Fonterra and Fitch and Federated Farmers, kind of through their evidence about should there be annual reporting on such numbers. The planning JWS agreed that there should be regular reporting. We all mean different things by the term regular. Some meant it as annual. I saw it as sort of 5 yearly to keep an eye out, because every 5 years the farm plan needs to be reviewed. And I would like to see at that point that you can check on the kind of stocking rate trends and things on the farm at that point. It's not explicitly stated that's the information provided, but again, coming back to Schedule D1, Part D, Number 2A, to demonstrate that you're not increasing the production of the contaminants, you need to have such information. board as part of that demonstration. So I don't think we've quite pinned it down, and I think I noted last week too that I quite like the idea that Federated Farmers have suggested in their latest revision of the rules to show to say that farmers need to keep a record of their stock and rate and nitrogen scorecard. I think that's a good idea, because then you can use those records at the 5-year reviews to get an understanding of whether we're increasing.
So really what you're saying is that for consistency reasons, these reviews or information should be provided at the same 5-year period?
To be consistent with the regulations, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. Yeah, the reason I asked the question, because I couldn't find certainty as to what was proposed.
Yes.
So if it is made as 5 years, you'd be comfortable with that?
Yes, well, that's what I'm proposing. It was originally 3-yearly reviews under PC1 when the regs came out. To me, it felt better to align those the terms for reviews.
I think that's very helpful. Now, I'd just like to come back to the one that has caused quite a bit of problem, and that's the issue of overseer.
Yes.
And I'm aware that the MFE has been quite specific that you should not use overseer for actual numbers.
Yes.
But they have not said, to my knowledge, that you can't use it for comparison purposes. Is that your understanding?
I don't think they've said anything that specific about comparison, no.
Because where I'm coming from is that the we're only talking about this as a rule gateway.
Yes.
And there are circumstances where some people may want to use overseer, because that's how they do it.
Yes.
Would there be any problem, for the purposes only of a rule gateway, that you could use the risk scorecard for dairy?
Yes.
If CVP has a risk scorecard that's proven by the time this plan is operative, could that be used as the basis for, or it doesn't come? Is there a gateway issue there or not for CVP?
I don't think we need to worry about the gateway given the way the
right
frame
for
CVP. Yeah.
And dry stock, if they were to come up with a risk scorecard for dry stock,
yes.
Could that be used there instead of the stocking unit rule?
Yes, it certainly could be if we have such a tool.
Do you see any merit in leaving flexibility for all of those things? Because it's not inconsistent with the principle of the decisions version of allowing alternatives. You've got the issue of comparability with the overseer thing.
Yeah.
But in principle, in practical terms, do you see any reason why you couldn't allow for some kind of alternatives to whatever goes in the final document?
If you ask my professional planning view, then the ideal is to have one gateway so that there's no room for gaming in terms of which rule to get into. I mean, that's the ideal.
I do understand, but we're not in an ideal rule.
Well, that's right, and so there is the whole practicality issue. And we might have to trade off some of the ideal for something else less ideal that made the whole thing workable. I think it's possible to do that. I think we still have to be quite, in my view, restrictive as to which tools you do use. So I wouldn't like to open it out to potential tools that we don't know anything about at this stage.
Certainly, I understand.
Yeah. It's certainly possible to use overseer and the scorecard as two tools. I haven't supported it because from a purist sort of planning point of view, it's not ideal. It's not a good idea from my point of view.
I do understand that.
Yeah.
But I'm also used to working in a world where we're not in a perfect world.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to make less than perfect choices.
Yes.
To get things underway.
Yes, I agree.
And you've heard the court raise concerns about Section 293 for overseer.
Yes.
And certainly from my point of view, anything that delays getting this underway for 6 months should be avoided if it's all possible.
Yes, and I agree with that. I mean, the other concern I have with overseer, and it was raised in a number of appeals, is this problem of versions, and I haven't yet seen a good way to fix that problem. So, I mean, we know that there are going to be different that will mean that with one version, a farm will register a certain, obviously a number. With another version, it could register with a different number. There are ways to address that, but no easy ways. I understand they have plenty in terms of their use of overseer, that they use sort of a standard dairy farm or a standard beef farm or something. And
yes.
And they have to keep changing things in terms of their consent limits when the versions change. I don't know if we want to go there, but I just haven't seen a simple way of addressing that version problem yet.
Do we have a situation here, though, where you only need one version to set the gateway for the majority of farms in the region?
The problem is that my understanding, I mean, and that's what we did in Taupo originally. We set a version and we locked it down and said, this is the version. Since moving to Overseer FM and the online version, my understanding is there is only one version available at any time that people can use. They can't just stick with one version anymore.
Okay. But it is of quite serious concern to me, and I think other members of the court, Section 293.
Yes, sir. And well, it is to us as well. So.
I just want to dig into the acknowledged risk of having two gateways, either different tools or, as you just pointed out, different versions of Overseer. In terms of the plan change, for dairy farmers, there are three gradations, but essentially really two gradations out there between moderate and high risk.
Yes, I mean, I see it as three.
I understand.
Yes.
All right, but you, okay, three,
yeah.
Fine. I mean, the gateway stage is actually a fairly coarse drafting stage, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
And leaving consenting quite separate, because a whole different range of things would come into that.
Yes.
But the consenting stage would have a lot more fine-tuned and farm-specific information for that decision, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Right. So the only real issue we need to contend with then is to make sure that the three stages are reasonably clear and that the opportunities for gaming or
yes.
misdrafting
yes.
are minimised as far as practical.
Yes, I agree.
You agree? Okay.
Absolutely.
And so we can confine the problem reasonably far, can't we? Or is there still a problem even at that course three choice stage?
It does depend on just how much flexibility there is and how big the margins are, if you like, between between. So I agree in principle. I'm just not sure where we might land on this in terms of how much room there is for gaming.
Can I come in on that one? Because I thought there'd been some work done that showed it's really at the edges rather than any major risk of going from...
I think that's true.
Yeah. So we've got to be practical.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's what we're asking you to be.
Yes.
And it sounds to me as though you have no compelling reason to say that Overseer could not work in particular circumstances. Would that be...
Nothing beyond what I've said, that's right.
Yeah, okay. So if the court were to find a way of addressing the concerns you've raised,
yes.
not completely, we won't be able to do that,
sure.
but satisfy ourselves that it's an appropriate step to go,
yes.
you would not see the need to go for Section 293, or would you still see the need to go for Section 293?
No, I think if there is a way of doing it, then let's do it.
Okay, that's good, thank you. Now, another specific question, different topic, and I have raised this before, is how are the contaminant discharges from dairy cattle winded off-site and from dairy dry stock temporarily moved off-site how are they accounted for in the overall catchment accounting system?
In the overall catchment accounting system?
Well, like, what I'm concerned about is that we quite often hear that stock is wintered off-site, therefore the nitrogen losses are reduced.
Yes.
But they must be going somewhere.
Yes.
And I want to know how they're considered.
I mean, the way I see that is that whatever happens, the rules, the thresholds need to be by the by. So if you're a farm that accepts deer grazers over the winter period, then that farm needs to bring that into their stock and rate accounts. And so in terms of which rule they fit into, it's accounted in that way.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, like all I've seen so far is the fact that it's wintered off-site.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that if it's being accounted anywhere else in the system. You're saying it will have to be.
Well, it needs to be. Whether there's any gaming and playing around with, well, I'm shifting cattle in and out, or they're in there for these months, but they're not in that month, so it changes the winter stocking rate calculation. I'm less sure if it's going to accurately account for it like that, but it tries to.
Okay, no, that's fine. And I'd just like to pick up on a point that His Honour discussed with you last time in terms of CVP.
Yes.
And I've looked at that a little bit more closely, and I see that there are some CVP operations where they've got half their operation in one subcatchment, half their operation in another subcatchment.
Yes.
So they're going to have to say we have two subcatchments to start off. They
yes.
may well also be able to say that they have traditionally rotated their crops in a third or fourth or fifth subcatchment.
Yes.
Would you see any problem in a situation where a CVP grower can say, in the last 10 years, my worst case situation is that I've had 110 hectares and it's been the main farm in catchments A and B and some rotation in catchments C, D, and E. That's not making anything worse. It's staying basically within the worst year in the 10-year period.
Yes.
Would you see a problem in that? Because I think that may go at least some way towards addressing the CVP concerns, but not necessarily the whole way.
The way I see it is that for the control activity to work, for this kind of series of controlled discretionary non-complying for CVP to work, we need to have a clear number or a clear benchmark, and that was the word I think that rule for CVP, the existing CVP used,
right.
A clear benchmark for how much CVP was used in each subcatchment so that we can know with future changes to that, what those changes could mean for the ability to meet the targets for each subcatchment. I mean, ideally we would know at the date of notification how much area of each subcatchment each grower was using, because that is the kind of the benchmark for existing, it's a proxy, I guess, for existing CVP, which then gives us a number for each subcatchment that if you go over that, then it's new CVP. But it's all kind of, you know, it's difficult, but we've still got to have some way of assessing what that benchmark was at point of notification for existing CVP. So the panel came up with one way of doing it. It's not necessarily the only way of doing it. And I think as we had a discussion at lunchtime even, that it could have been that we choose one year, latest year, notification year, and ask each grower how much CVP were they using in each subcatchment at that date. That'd be another way.
I'm suggesting.
Yes, yes. So that's another way of doing it, maybe a better way. I'm not sure the reasons why the panel chose the way they did. But
yes, where I'm coming from is, and I keep saying we're not in a perfect world.
Yes.
If a farm uses 100 hectares overall,
yes,
and there's two or three more hectares in one subcatchment than another in any particular year, that's not going to affect the catchment accounting to any significant
extent.
No,
probably not, two or three, but, you know, 100 or so might.
Well, we're not talking about 100. because they've got their main site, which they nominate. Our main growing area is in Catasauqua,
yes.
and
yes.
And maybe there's 10 hectares or 20 hectares,
yes.
or another number.
Yes.
So we're not talking about huge risks here. So it's really trying to get something that protects what you're concerned with. I understand exactly why you're concerned, but it strikes me as it's not a huge issue for any individual farmer. They're not talking about moving their whole 100 hectares from one subcatchment into another. They're talking about moving a small proportion of it. And I'm sure that the CVP, we'll hear from council if I'm wrong in this, but we want to try and enable people to operate efficiently, and this seems to be an important consideration of operating efficiently for CVP.
Yes.
And it does seem to me that it may not be the big issue that you might have thought it is.
Perhaps not. I just think we need to have some reasonable idea of the quantum of CVP in each subcatchment for the thing to work,
yeah.
whatever that might be.
Yeah. Okay.
And that quantum, I mean, you've said it might be taken at a particular year, but the issue is it should still take account of the fact that in that year there may have been areas that were not planted because it was in rotation.
Yes.
And
yes.
I would have thought that there shouldn't be any problem with saying, well, that should still be included because that's cropping land, it's
yes.
not dry stock land, it's not dairy land, it's not in forest.
Yes.
It is held by someone, and it doesn't matter who, because it could be leased to anyone.
Yes.
But nonetheless, it's effectively dedicated to a cropping purpose over time.
Yes, I think that's fair, sir.
Right. Okay.
Sorry to ask you all these detailed questions, but they come to the crunch of it now, how,
yes.
how the court makes this decision.
Yes.
Doctor, sorry, the issue of stock units and what constitutes stock units, I'm still a little bit concerned because PC1 still talks about 10.4 stock units for a dairy cow, and I've seen other people, like in the MAF standard or something else, they're talking about quite significantly lower figures, 7 or 8. Are you sure that they're the right numbers in PC1 at the moment?
I'm not sure that they're the right numbers, if there is a right number, because it depends on how you define the cow, you know, in terms of age group or whatever. I don't think there is a standard stock unit number without having it really pinned down to the animal itself, describing the animal. I think Fero Thomas have tried to do that in their changes as well.
Mm.
My view is the important thing is that we have a number for each type of animal and that type of animal is described clearly. I don't think we actually need that third column in the table of stock units because that seems to be the thing that's confusing it, if you like. We may need a better first column in terms of describing the animal.
What page are we on?
So we're looking at...
79,
yes.
Well, the third column is essentially the source for where that figure in the second column is coming from, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, sir.
But ultimately, in terms of a regulatory function, it's just a question of whether or not the numbers in the second column are generally reasonable.
That's right, sir.
And of course, in a regulatory setting, as with so many things, speed limits and so on, there's an element of arbitrariness about it, but
yes.
that's in order to make the thing practicable, make
yes.
it work.
Yes, as long as when it says dairy bull, we know exactly what we mean by dairy bull.
And you could raise a question about whether or not, as you go down that list, how important is it to draw a distinction between
sure.
some of the gradations there?
Yes. So, yes, the easiest solution is just get rid of third column.
Yeah.
And then we've got type of animal, stocking rate, at least it's something we can apply reasonably easily without getting into the discussion too much about exactly what kind of animal that is, weight-wise.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I'm just not sure if 10.4 is correct or 7.8 or something like that and whether that's significant.
Yes, and I don't know the answer to that. So
perhaps the farming community, Mr. Matheson, could come back to us on that at some stage. Give us some advice on that.
Yes.
That's all I was really asking for. Thank you. Dr. Rose proposed in paragraph 51C of his evidence in chief that there's a need to account for natural variability and sampling error when assessing progress on achieving attribute states. In other words, you can get a wet period and that affects how much nitrogen goes into the environment, for example. And he recommended an approach combining state, trend and pressure analysis to test whether water quality has been maintained, improved or degraded. And he recommended some wording to go there, but you have not picked that up. Is there a reason for that, please?
I take my advice on the science methods from Dr. Scar's book, and my understanding was that he didn't support that.
Okay.
Yes, and I don't have any better information.
All right, thank you.
Science.
I'm getting close to the end. Seen any particular reference to the precautionary principle through the various documents. Is there any requirement to consider that?
There's no explicit requirement in PC1 as such with those words. I'd suggest that was in the mind of the hearing panel as they were setting the provisions that, you know, if we didn't have good information, we needed to be pretty careful with what we were allowing. So I assume it's been, and it's only assumption, that it has been taken into account, but no, there's no specific reference to that in the provision.
And not in the NPSFN 2020?
I can't remember the wording. I think it is part of the NPSFN.
I thought it was, but I couldn't see precautionary.
Yes, I can't remember either.
Yeah, okay. No, I can check that. So thank you very much indeed. Those are my questions. Thank you.
So on wetlands, the definition that is used in PC1 is what?
I think it's the RMA definition.
The various RMA and I think there's some versions of it in the NPSFN as well.
Yes.
Okay. So that everyone knows that's the.
It's not defined. In PC1, I'm pretty sure the regional plan or policy statement defines it as the RMA version. But I'll take a check.
Okay. So it's not worth putting that commentary in your list of definitions so that we can know where to look for what that wetland is?
Could be. I don't know if anyone's specifically asked for that, for wetlands as such to be defined in the glossary.
So, in terms of the against on wetlands, so from the question that Commissioner Hodges asked you about that, where the 50 square metre minimum size limit came from,
yes,
was from the hearings panel.
That's right.
And that was just brought in to provide some,
yes,
minimum level where there hadn't been a minimum previously. So as far as you know, there hasn't been no like Section 32 analysis of what that would support that particular number.
That's right, as far as I know. And like I say, the panel's comment on that was specifically that there was no full Section 32 cost-benefit analysis on that matter.
I just picked up in one of the paragraphs of your rebuttal evidence where an appellant was seeking an increase in the wetland minimum area to 500 square metres.
Yes.
And you commented that had not been justified on Section 32 grounds to bring it to 500.
Yes.
But there's also no
that's true,
equivalent so. Justification for
that's
50
true.
Square metres either.
That's right.
Okay. Schedule C talks about the fencing, stuff exclusion, and the slope angle.
Yes.
Whether it's 10-degree slope or greater than or less than a 10-degree slope. And that is tied to, as identified in the Ministry for the Environment, stock exclusion, low slope map.
Yes.
There seems been some discussion that, with the introduction of LIDAR
yes.
data, that the determination of, quite accurate determination of slope should be possible.
Yes.
And in fact, just looking at the LIMS data service website, I see that all of the northern area of PC1 is now available as a digital elevation model.
Okay. Yes, I wasn't
1 metre.
It
came there a week ago. On the 25th of September. So the information. Well, the data is available now
yes.
to accurately map
yes.
the degree classes of the slopes,
yes.
at least in the northern part of the PC1 area. And my understanding is that the LIDAR data has been obtained for the rest of the Waikato Regional Council area, and that will very shortly be available in the same way.
Yes.
So, my point is, by saying that it has to be identified as identified in the Ministry of the Environment, Stock Exclusion, and Low Slope, does that leave room for this new, much more accurate determination of slope to be used as well?
Yes, I think if
alternatively.
I think if we've got a PC1 specific map based on LIDAR, we would be better to use that than the MUV map.
So does the wording of Schedule C not the way it's written? The way it's worded at the moment doesn't seem to allow for some alternative way, or specifically the LIDAR, to be used as a determination of this slope.
That's right, because I'm not aware that we've got that map yet. I mean, I've talked a number of times to our GIS people over the last couple of years about that, and we know that LIDAR is coming, and that we're getting very close, if we're not already there, of full coverage for the Waikato region, or at least PC1 region area. Once we have all of that data, and I understand that GIS guys have been doing some work on this as well, we need to map it in a certain way. They still have to map it at some level that kind of, it's not the exact line that they map necessarily as a LIDAR map. They take a line that means that you don't get little areas, for example, that are really steep, or they try and do it in a way that makes sense at a farm scale, whereas the LIDAR data itself, to my understanding, is very, very detailed data.
Yeah, there's some smoothing that's required.
Exactly. So I don't know if they've got that finalised yet. I know they've been working on it for some time. So once we've got a map, it would be a much better map, in my view, to use than the MUV map. But at the time that we're writing this, that was all we had.
It would seem to me, from my understanding and of my use of GIS and doing that sort
yes.
of process, it's not that time consuming, and it should be a bit, depending on how much GIS resource you wish to put into that process,
yeah.
it should be available by the end of the year.
Oh, yes.
It could be available by the end of the year.
So
perhaps I'm just wondering why the plan doesn't provide, allow for that to be brought in, rather than locking in this much coarser and...
Yes, it could do. We could rewrite it that way. moment, it's like the thresholds and the tools. I've been writing this based on what we have available right now. And so far, and up until very recently, as I said before, we hadn't completed all the writing covered, was my understanding. But I'd always expected that we would deal with this through the plan change, you know, by the end of next year, that we should, that should give us time to tidy up the whole LiDAR situation and give us a map that we can put out there with a notified version of that plan. That's how I thought it should be best part of it.
The last minor point is in the definitions just of critical source area on page 76.
Yes.
Talks about areas that accumulate runoff. In listening to some answers to questions on this, both from yourself and from other council witnesses, I thought I understood that some aspect of critical source areas were specific sites like around a trough, a laneway, at gates and things where there's like high traffic areas, the ground is compacted, there's limited vegetation cover, there's a low infiltration areas, there's bare ground, they're going to be a sort of spot source of quite a considerable amount of contaminants, particularly sediment in the runoff.
Yep.
And just reading that critical source area definition, I wondered whether that it referred to things like landscape features such as a gully, a swale, or a depression. And I wondered whether the specific things that were being identified as critical source areas were actually obvious to be included in that definition. I couldn't see how they naturally fell out of that definition.
There was quite a bit of discussion of the definition through mediation. What I've proposed to do is use the NES freshwater definition, and again, sort of just so that we've got one definition that we're using.
And is that the one that's there now?
Yes. That's one of the proposing, yes. Having said that, we've heard evidence that MFE have got discussion documents about how to apply it, which in some senses don't directly align with the definition as I read it. But anyway, that is the